Georgia Plessis from the University of the Free State.
Thank you very much. Ryan, okay, what's my speech? Thank you, and a warm welcome to the Graveyard Shift. Yes, it's such an honor and privilege to be here today, as I'm given the opportunity to ask feedback and assistance from an expert group of persons regarding my PhD, and this has been a difficult journey for me. Therefore, my intentions are not clear, and I'm here to benefit from your expertise as I venture into the challenging parts of my PhD studies. Now, this presentation only touches on the margins of a deeply complex and philosophical issue, and the issues at hand are extremely complicated. It is also not only religion that is argued for, but all ideologies and beliefs held by persons. Of course, this PhD involves the definition of religion, the secular, proselytism, what is religion, what is the difference between church and state, what is secular defined as a religion, and what is the difference between the public and the private sphere, and whether there should be such a difference. Also, I've been reading Dewey, Plato, Aristotle, many of which I don't understand yet. I'm getting there, and these all include part of my PhD studies. But today I want to focus on a very small part of my PhD regarding the inclusion of religion in South African school education, with specific focus on public school education. Now, during apartheid, schools in South Africa, as elsewhere, reflected the society's political and philosophical goals. A group of Afrikaner churches proposed an education program, Christian National Education, CNE, which I will refer to as now. Article 15 of the Christian National Education Policy Act of 1948 explains the basis of apartheid, and I quote, "We believe that the calling and task of white South Africa with regard to the native is to Christianize him and help him on culturally, and that this calling and task has already found its nearer focusing in the principles of trusteeship, no equality, and segregation," end quote. Now, the current position is, in South Africa, of course, we know is different. Such discrimination is hopefully never to be repeated again. As stated by Van der Vijver, the drafters of the South African Constitution rejected segregation of rival ethnic, religious and linguistic communities, and also rejected the promotion of cultural, religious or linguistic homogeneity as a means of counteracting group-related tensions in the country's social construct. Instead, they opted for what Desmond Tutu called a rainbow people. And the right to freedom of religion is supported in sections 9, 15 and 29 of the Constitution, and also in many of the cases that Judge Albie Sachs mentioned, the Lawrence case, the Fury case, Settlers High School, and many others. Now, the problem is that because the exclusion of religious and ideological diversity in the past should be avoided, it is of paramount importance to determine whether there is the slightest possibility of discrimination or inequality regarding religion in education today, because we want to prevent what happened in the past, and because we have a constitution that requires us to look at whether our system adheres to education, freedom, human dignity, and diversity. And first I want to look at what we have in life orientation, religion education and religious instruction. Religion education, the National Education Policy of 2003 states that religion education is an objective teaching of the facts of various religions that we find in South Africa. So it's part of the curriculum and it is justified, and it's justified as a compulsory subject. And because of the fact that it's objective, if there is such a thing, an objective teaching of religion. Whereas religious instruction is the way we teach religion in the family, trying to convert persons, teaching them about the principles of the Bible or the Quran, which is, according to the national policy, inappropriate for education under our constitution. So we follow the approach of religion education, and the national policy states that religion should be promoted in society, and this is done by way of religion education. In other words, the objective teaching of religion in schools. The second example I want to share with you is sex education. This is also a compulsory subject, part of life orientation. And here, subjects are taught like, for example, grades 10 to 12 receive compulsory lessons on gender roles, decision-making regarding sexuality, reproduction, stereotypical views of gender roles, sexual abuse, teenage pregnancy, sexually transmitted diseases, sexual interest, abstinence, sexuality, and lifestyle choices. Now, it is argued that subjects such as religion education and sex education should be provided to children and should be available to children or their parents if they choose this. It is important, since refusing to do so may amount to censorship as was implemented during apartheid. However, it should be the choice of the parent as to whether they wish to apply self-censorship and whether they choose to exercise their right to freedom of religion and conscience and not expose their children to these subjects. It is argued that the appropriateness of religion education and sex education is not necessarily constitutionally impartial. And this I also critique in my PhD. And then what I always say is that different forms of democracy will also render different answers to such an issue. For example, in France, the idea of negative neutrality will render religious instruction as, and here you will see religious instruction is the one on your right-hand side. It will render, in France, negative neutrality will render religious instruction as unconstitutional, whereas in Belgium, positive neutrality, the positive neutrality approach, where there is a positive promotion of the development of religion, exists. Also, the objective teaching of religion by way of religion education might be discriminatory against the religious freedom and conscience of certain parents. As mentioned, although an express right to mandate the state to provide religious instruction is not provided for, according to Van der Schaaf, the right of parents to direct their children's education in conformity with their own beliefs should at least enable parents not to have their children exposed to religious aspects of education. Should religious classes form part of the public school curriculum, the attendance at such classes must be voluntary. And also, nothing in the Schools Act allows for parents to play a role in sex education. It is merely these subjects in life orientation given from an objective perspective, if an objective perspective is possible. What I would like to talk about is the duties placed on the state to and civil society to include religion within schools, public schools. Now they mentioned possible threats to the inclusion of religion and the protection of religious freedom within South African public schools requires solutions by the state and the community. Now this presentation will focus mainly on civil and political rights and socio-economic rights. In the Constitution, section 29(1)(a) provides for the right to basic education. And this is seen as a socio-economic right and places a positive duty on the state to realize this right. It is an absolute and an unqualified right. On the contrary, we have section 15, which provides for the right to religious freedom. This is a civil and political right and places negative duties on the state, which means that the state must just refrain from impinging on the right to religious freedom. What I would like to argue is that the distinction between socio-economic rights and civil and political rights, and hence the difference between positive and negative duties on the state, has a specific historical context and therefore is an oversimplification of human rights. It will then be argued that the fact that the right to religious freedom is a civil and political right does not have the effect of placing only a negative duty on the state, but also places a positive duty on the state to realize this right. In 1952, the General Assembly instructed the Commission on Human Rights to draft two covenants dealing with these two sets of rights separately. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, dealing with civil and political rights, and then the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. But the reason for these two covenants were ideological. And it was because of the Cold War and the difference between the West and the East. So the difference between the grouping of these two forms of rights was as a result of two ideologies resulting from the Cold War and the differences between the West and the East. Now, civil and political rights largely emphasize the notions of autonomy, freedom, and individuality. And an argument can be made that an expanded understanding of natural rights could give rise to socio-economic rights. For example, Locke's concern for property rights is illustrative of this point. Rights to property were, for Locke, simply a means of ensuring autonomy and liberty. It is therefore not feasible to argue that modern civil and political rights are conceptually different to modern socio-economic rights. The assumption that civil and political rights places negative duties on the state and socio-economic rights places positive duties on the state is also superficial. Hsu argues that all basic rights contain both positive and negative obligations, and that all rights give rise to three levels of obligation, and this might sound familiar. The duty to avoid depriving, the duty to protect from deprivation, and the duty to aid the deprived. Reading section 7, subsection 2 of the South African Constitution, we find this in the duty to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill the rights in question, which restates these principles of Hsu. And also, at a conceptual level, any attempt to determine whether something is a positive right and therefore requires state action, or a negative right which only requires state inaction, rests upon one's initial vantage point. Everyone has a normative baseline understanding of the role of the state and a specific conception of human freedom. Therefore, when there was a debate as to whether to include social economic rights within the South African Constitution, it was stated that if social economic rights are to be included, it will surpass and this distinction made between social economic rights and civil and political rights. And we also see this in Section 7, where our Constitution does not view socio-economic rights and civil and political rights as separately, where only a positive duty is placed on the state in specific instances. Section 7 says that a positive duty to realize the Bill of Rights is placed in all instances of rights. And this means that there is a positive duty on the state to realize religious freedom even in education. Then, all religions are treated substantively equally, and therefore substantive equality must be truly transformative and not only inclusionary. In other words, if we just include a lot of religions in one objective subject, right, religion education, in my opinion, it would amount to formal equality. And it includes religion, but it doesn't transform society. It doesn't transform schools that might, due to historical reasons, still discriminate against religion. And therefore, substantive equality, as stated in Section 9 of the Constitution, requires transformative equality in the promotion of religious freedom. Fredman states that a commitment to redressing disadvantage, combating social exclusion, and facilitating positive participation all requires positive revision. Therefore, the idea of substantive equality itself places a duty on the state to act positively in the realization of religious freedom within public schools. Then, it may be argued that the realization of religious freedom within education can place an undue burden on the state. I'm not going to deal with this now, I do deal with it in my PhD. But lastly, actively promoting the right to religious freedom in education is not only necessary in the sense that money should be provided to schools, another 5 policies written which will anyway not be applied properly and changed in another 5 years again. And also, Janssen states that our government simply does not have the capacity, the commitment, or the competence in many fields that our people need. And therefore, the community needs to act. Therefore, I argue that not only the state has this duty, but the community also has this positive duty to realize and include religion within education. In fact, it is argued within and because of the South African circumstances and the amount of corruption in government, civil society now has the primary duty in the realization of their own rights. These duties are not only relevant to the state, but also to the community. Carrying the interests of the local schools. These include parents, learners, religious institutions, welfare institutions, and other members of the community. Religious institutions and the rest of civil society cannot play fiddle while Rome is burning. And it is agreed with Westhuizen et al. That justice is community-orientated and avoids social atomism and individualism. The education system that evolved after 1994 represents a compromise between a centralized and a decentralized system. It was generally accepted that the state could not provide public education of a sufficiently high quality on its own, and the Schools Act therefore recognizes the importance of a democratic society where everyone, including the private sector, accept the responsibility for the organization, governance, and funding of schools in partnership with the state. The idea is also not that rights treat beneficiaries as passive recipients of the state's welfare. In that, I believe that pride in one's school and religious freedom in a school requires building from the bottom down, from the bottom up by society. Therefore, it is argued that a positive and negative duty is placed on the state and civil society to both realize and promote religious freedom and the inclusion of religion within public school education. Justice Lalga drove the point of the Belay judgment home by concluding that the display of religion and culture in public, he said, is not a parade of horrible, but a pageant of diversity which will enrich our schools and in turn our country. I thank you.
Thank you, Georgia. First question? We take two questions for 5 minutes for questions. Come.
Just thank you for a very good presentation and just a small little comment. If you look at the 1993 Vienna Convention of the United Nations on Human Rights, you will see there were two predominant problems. One is the problem of universality of human rights or the relativity of human rights. The other was the relationship between civil and political rights and economic, social and cultural rights. The first problem is normally referred to as the East-West problem, and the second is the North-South problem, because the idea was that universality of human rights is something that's typical Western, and Muslim communities, for example, say that they must be subject to religion and culture and so on, their relativity. That is an East-West divide. But the big other problem was developed countries laid great stress on civil and political rights, while the South, the developing countries, said what's the use of freedom of speech if many people cannot, freedom of the press, if many people can't read or write, or the right to vote if you don't have a roof over your head. So that the South was the one that emphasized economic and social rights, and the North civil and political rights. So the East-West, the relativity and universality, North-South, the civil and political economic social rights.
Thank you, Professor. Any comment from you? No.
Yes. Thank you, Prof. I appreciate that. I also just wanted to say that I do believe that it will be difficult in a South African situation for a person who is hungry and who doesn't have a roof over their head to worry about, to be able to exercise their civil and political rights. I do believe that one will first have to get one thing right and then go to the next. So it is going to be difficult to exercise civil and political rights if you don't have the basic needs that you should have. And thank you for that comment. I will definitely put that into my thesis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Georgia, for an excellent paper. It was really very stimulating. Thank you for that. I just want to make the remark that the Constitution of South Africa in Article 234 provides for additional, that Parliament can accept additional charters of rights in order to enhance the culture of democracy in South Africa. Last night I asked Judge Sachs for his comments on what he wrote, that ideally religions would get together and formulate the rights that they deem necessary for them to make a contribution. And he referred to the fact that he's aware of attempts in South Africa to formulate those rights. And I know you also know about the South African Charter of Religious Rights and Freedoms. On Thursday we have the annual general meeting of the Council for Religious Rights and Freedoms, also here in this hotel. It's a separate meeting, but if any of you want to attend it, you are very welcome. And Article 7 of that charter says every person has the right to be educated or to educate their children or have them educated in accordance with their religious or philosophical views. There are four or five sub-articles to that. But will you mind to give a comment on this, please?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Prof. I agree that right should exist to be, and this also involves the rights between the parents and the state, the parents and the child, which can become very complicated, and there's a whole philosophical issue about it in international law as well. I do believe that parents should have retained that right to educate their children in line with their beliefs. And I do not think the state has a place to entangle or reach out into that area and interfere, except in circumstances that it is really necessary, and you'll have to define that as well. But I do believe that if you do that and you include the right of parents to be able to educate their children in line with their beliefs, it will have to be in a very sensitive manner. It will have to be in a very nuanced manner, and it will also have to be inclusive. And that is why I state that it will take a great attempt from civil society, because I have my doubts as to whether our government will even worry about implementing this, taking into account all the other problems they have. So it will take a great attempt and a great duty on civil society and religious institutions to aid the schools and take hands with schools to promote this nuanced, sensitive, inclusive approach to religion in education, to enable parents to exercise that right. Thank you.
Thank you. The fact that I'm speaking doesn't make it less important.
No, I do believe the fact that it's difficult and the fact that it's not done yet is partly our own fault and the fault of many religious institutions that should take positive action in this regard, as they are doing in the Charter. Thank you.
Thank you very much.